story is told of a young fellow who wanted to be a star journalist, but he lived in a small town, so there were not a lot of opportunities for exciting news to be reported. But one day, the dam upstream broke and the town was flooded. And so, sensing an opportunity, he got in a rowboat. He headed out to look for his big story. And as he was rowing about, he found a lady sitting on top of her rooftop. And so he rowed to the house and tied up his boat. And together they sat there on the roof, watching the various items float by. Maybe there would be a story, he thought, somewhere in the flood. So as something would float by, she would say to him, because he'd explained to her why he was there, she would say, "Well, there's a story." And he would say, "No, that's not a story." And so it would come and go, and they did this several times. And finally, they notice a hat that floats by, goes downstream, but then it stops, and it turns around 180, and it goes upstream. And then it stops, and it turns around, goes downstream. And the young man says, "Now there's a story." And the woman says, "No, that's not a story. That's my husband, Hayford. He said he was going to mow the lawn come hell or high water." Now, the young man was determined to get his story, but I don't think he was determined, as Hayward was, to mow that lawn. This year, the United Youth Camp theme was Leaders, People of Character, and we started a series of sermons on those, covering those themes as well. And as I've said previously, this is a great theme, and not just for teens. I like it because it gets into the specifics of what kind of leader God is looking for. The leaders of the world are carnal. That is, they look for selfish leadership, how much money they can make, what kind of return for the investors, whether they can squeeze more out of vendors or employees. And it's effective in the short term, but it's unhealthy in the long term. We see evidence of that all around us. God, however, expects for us to be leaders who reflect His nature, His character, not the world's expectation of what leadership is. And this character is being lost in our culture, and I fear for our country, because when it's truly gone, I think we'll pay a very heavy price for that. Commitment, integrity, determination, courage, and vision are all core godly character values. And while they may be seen in some, they're lost in most. God shows us in Scripture what true leaders are, how they behave, people who serve and lead by example. And to go back to the definition I gave previously, character is simply knowing right from wrong and choosing to do the right thing. The first sermon in this series, we looked at the component of godly character that is commitment. Last week, we added to that the value of integrity. And today, we're going to continue this series covering the next aspect of this rehearsal of God's character, and that is determination. The third part of godly character is determination. What does it mean to have determination? It's simply having a purpose to accomplish the right goals, regardless of the obstacles or opposition. We see determination in things like the Olympics, the time, the dedication, the effort that has to be given day in and day out for years in cases to be the type of athlete at that level to participate in those games. Why is this important? We can look at something like the Olympics, and it's very temporary, isn't it? So in considering this aspect of character, why should we? Why does a leader need to have determination in God's eyes? Well, simply put, determination separates the dreamers from the doers. There are a lot of people that would love to participate in the Olympics, right? How many would be willing to put in the effort? A lot of people that want to achieve certain things in life, but they don't have the determination. And as the old expression goes, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. It's not enough to have the desire. You have to have the determination to go with it. It's not enough to know what is right, to know what godly character is. We have to put it into action. Because there are many who dream of accomplishing things, but few are willing to make the sacrifices necessary to achieve that. To better consider this component of godly character that we're talking about today, that is determination, we're going to take a look at a biblical example through the life or the story of Nehemiah, if you want to begin turning there with me. His story is a very interesting story. It is a story of not only discernment, but courage and wisdom and discernment. We'll see some of that as we go through this story. To set the stage a little bit, Nehemiah, the time period of this book, is during the captivity of Judah during the time of the Persian rule. The Babylonians had taken the southern tribes captive. The Babylonian Empire had fallen. Persia was now the dominant power. Nehemiah, like Daniel, was in the high echelons of the government. Nehemiah's story begins somewhere in the wintertime of 445 or so B.C. in the home of King Artaxerxes of Persia. Earlier, some 54,000 Jews had returned with Joshua and Zerubbabel from Babylon. When they fell, they left to go back to Jerusalem almost 90-some years earlier. Shortly before Nehemiah's story of 12 years or so, Ezra had left Persia with a much smaller number, about 1,700 or so, of the tribe of Judah going back to Jerusalem as well. So with that context, then, we begin in chapter 1. And we find that Nehemiah was, his title, his responsibility, if you will, was to be a cupbearer to the king. This was not just a matter of being a waiter. He was not just the one to bring him food and drink. His responsibility was to make sure that the king's food and wine was not poisoned. Now, how do you do that? You take a bite and you have a sip of wine in his presence of what he's going to eat. If you fall over dead, he doesn't eat it or drink it. If you go about your business, then he knows that he can have the full course. Now, that's not just a passive thing. Nehemiah is not hoping and praying every time he's going to take a bite of the king's food or drink some of his wine. He's very proactive. He's making sure the wine is secure, that not just anybody has access to it. He's making sure and probably watching how the food is prepared. And he knows the cooks and he knows where the food is coming from and he keeps an eye on it. So as such, he becomes very trusted in the eyes of the king. So let's pick up the story here at the beginning of chapter 1. Verse 2, it says, It came to pass in the month of Kislev in the 20th year as I was in Shushan, the citadel. This is the winter home of Artaxerxes. The Hanani, one of my brethren, came with men from Judah, and I asked them concerning the Jews who had escaped, who had survived the captivity, and concerning Jerusalem. So travelers coming from Judea, Jerusalem area, to this area of Persia, and Nehemiah wants to know how everyone is doing. And so in verse 3, they said to me, the survivors who are left from the captivity in the province are in great distress and reproach. The wall of Jerusalem is, if I can insert here, is still broken down, and its gates are still not replaced. They were burnt, they're destroyed, and they're gone. So nothing much has changed. Again, close to 90 years has passed. And another, of those 90 years, 12 of those years, even since Ezra had gone back. And so notice then Nehemiah's reaction in verse 4. So it was when I heard these words that I sat down and wept. It so overwhelmed him to know that his countrymen were in such distress and they were being pressured from nations around because the walls weren't there. They were also not protected even from animals. And so not only did he weep, it says, he also says that he mourned for many days and that he fasted and prayed before God of heaven. He was humbling himself. And here in Nehemiah's example is one great thing that we would do well to emulate. And that is that when the problem was presented to him, he prayed to God and fasted regarding the situation, asking for God's favor. We'll get into that here a little bit. Let's continue in verse 5. And so he says here in this prayer, Lord God of heaven, O great and awesome God, you who keep your covenant and mercy with those who love you and observe your commandments, please let your ear be attentive to your and your eyes open, that you may hear the prayer of your servant So he says, he's reminding God, I know you listen to those who obey you, and I come before you in that light. Now, this is where he is now, but notice what he says here. He acknowledges, he's not glossing over why Judah is in Persia, why they were taken captive. He says, I know, let me back up. Your servant, which I pray before you now, day and night, for the children of Israel, your servant, and confess the sins of the children of Israel, which we have sinned against you. Both my father's house and I have sinned. So he's acknowledging the shortcomings that he has, that the nation had, that brought them to this point. What's also interesting in this verse is that he's not praying primarily for himself. His prayer is because of the concern of his fellow countrymen. Verse 7, we acted very corruptly against you. We did not keep your commandments, the statutes, or the ordinances which you commanded your servant Moses. Remember, I pray you, the word that you commanded your servant Moses, saying, if you are unfaithful, I will scatter you to the nations. But, verse 9, if you return to me and keep my commandments and do them, though some of you are cast out to the farthest parts of the heavens, I will gather them from there and bring them to the place which I have chosen as a dwelling for my name. And so then verse 10, now these are your servants and your people whom you have redeemed by your great power and your strong hand. We find here a very interesting context, because then as he finishes, he says, let your ear be attentive, the prayer of your servants who desire to fear your name, let your servant prosper. Again, he's not asking for himself here, even though he's praying this, because he's got something in mind, as we'll come to here in a moment. He says, I pray, grant him mercy in the sight of this man. And this is where we know that he was the cupbearer. He says, for I was the cupbearer. What he has in mind is for the right opportunity to be presented before the king, and he's going to ask him a favor. So, in chapter 2, verse 1, we find that at the beginning of the year, the month of Nisan, the 12th year of King Artaxerxes, when wine was before him, that I took the wine and gave it to the king. Now I had never been sad in his presence before. Nehemiah was taking a big risk here. It was not his right, if you will, to bring his problems to the king. His job was to make the king's life comfortable. The king didn't care about Nehemiah's problems. And the king notices, verse 2, and the king says to me, why is your face sad, seeing you're not sick? I know you're not ill, but I see something is troubling you. This is nothing but sorrow of heart, so I became dreadfully afraid. And at this point, this situation can go one of two directions. Either the king gets very mad and Nehemiah is in trouble, serious trouble, or the king, because of their relationship, decides to grant him at least a receptive ear, if not a favor. And so Nehemiah jumps in here in verse 3. May the king live forever. Why should my face not be sad when the city, the place of my father's tomb, lies waste and its gates are burned with fire? Then the king said to me, what do you request? And notice the end of verse 4. So I prayed to the God of heaven. Now he had already prayed and fasted. So this was not the heart of his conversation with God. This was a recorded instance of instant prayer. That is, in the situation, in Nehemiah's mind, he now then quickly asks God for the favor that he had asked for earlier. This is the occasion. And so verse 5, he says to the king, if it pleases the king, and if your servant has found favor in your sight, I ask that you send me to Judah, to the city of my father's tombs, that I may rebuild it. And the king said to me, and the queen also sitting beside him, how long will your journey be, and when will you return? So the king is essentially saying, okay, I'll allow you to do this as long as it doesn't take a long time. When will you be back? So it pleased the king to send me, and I set him a time. Furthermore, I said to the king, if it pleases the king, let letters be given to me for the governors of the region beyond the river, that they may permit me to pass, because they don't know Nehemiah. They don't know what he's up to. So essentially he's saying, as I travel to Jerusalem, I need to present to them documents that show that I'm on a journey that you are in agreement with. And so then he also asks in verse 8 for some of the king's resources. and a letter to Asaph, the king, the keeper of the king's forest, that he must give me timber to make beams for the gates of the citadel, which pertain to the temple and the city wall and the house that I will occupy. And the king granted them to me according to the good hand, notice, of my God upon me. Even though Nehemiah was the one with the relationship, even though Nehemiah was the one that served the king faithfully, even though Nehemiah was the one that the king trusted, Nehemiah knew where that favor came from. And so then verse 9, I went to the governors in the region, gave them the king's letters, and the king had sent captains of the army and horsemen with me. This is how highly it tells me that Artaxerxes favored Nehemiah, because he even sent him along an armed escort. So then notice verse 10. When Sanballat the Horonite, Tobiah the Ammonite, officials heard it, they were deeply disturbed that a man had come to seek the well-being of the children of Israel. These are rulers near Judah, and they're not happy that the situation looks like it's about to change. We'll come back to that thought. So we covered that Nehemiah was given a short leave from Artaxerxes, and then quick fashion, he arrives in Jerusalem. What would you expect if you didn't know the story of Nehemiah? What would you expect a leader to do first in this situation? From a carnal perspective, many times they'll sort of mark out their territory, okay? They'll define, you know, I'm the boss, and here's my office, and here's my expectations, and sort of lay down the law. Or some of them come in and they start making changes right away, you know? Sort of make their stamp, if you will. Maybe they come in and set up their, and it says here that Nehemiah was going to build himself a house. Maybe they come in and take care of their own needs first. Maybe they come in and they make a series of public speeches to impress everybody. I'm the one in charge, like a politician. I'm here. Now everything's going to be okay. Well, let's pick up the story in verse 11 of chapter 2. Notice, he comes to Jerusalem. And for 3 days, verse 12, I arose in the night, I and a few men with me, just a very small handful of men that he trusted. I told no one what my God had put in my heart to do at Jerusalem, nor was there any animal except with me except the one I rode on. And I went out by night through the valley gate to the serpent well and the refuge gate. I viewed the walls of Jerusalem, which were broken down, and its gates, which were burnt with fire. Then I went to the fountain gate, the king's pool. There was no room for the animal under me to pass. So he goes out. First thing he does to answer the question is, he goes out and assesses the problem. Before you can determine what to do, you need to know what needs to be done. And you need to know what it is that God wants you to do. And here he goes back up in verse 12. He says that I wanted to follow through on what God had put in my heart. So verse 15 talks about him going out into the valleys and viewing the wall from a distance even. He wanted to get a big overview of what was required here. And in verse 16, he didn't tell anyone. It wasn't that he was trying to do anything deceptive. He wanted to have his own information first before he started anything. And so then verse 17, he comes to the officials and he says, you see the distress that is the leadership that was already in Jerusalem. He says, you see the distress that we are in. We. See, he's thrown his lot in here. He's not saying you. He's including himself here in the solution. How Jerusalem lies waste and its gates are burned with fire. He says, I'm not telling you anything you don't know, but come, let us build the wall. Let's be at the matter at hand, that we may no longer be a reproach. I told them of the hand of my God, which had been good upon me. Maybe he recounted all the conversation he had with Artaxerxes, the favor that had been shown. He says also of the king's words that he had spoken to me. And so they said, let us rise up and build. Then they set their hands to do this good work. Determination can be infectious. Because now they had a determination. Why was this not already there? Probably a whole different story. But Nehemiah begins to give them a vision here. Let us rise up and build, he says here. But just because Nehemiah now has shown up on the scene doesn't mean that everything is smooth sailing. Now that the cavalry has ridden in, oftentimes that brings other things to the surface. And remember those critics that we read about earlier? Well, they're back now, and they're focused on harassing Nehemiah. They don't want this built. Why don't they want it built? Why don't they want the walls repaired and the gates put back on? Because if that's done, they can no longer control or harass the inhabitants. They can defend themselves. And so as we read earlier, Sanballat, Tobiah, and Geshem, and others were not happy at this. And Nehemiah was upsetting to their plans. And I'm sure that there is no one here that has ever had to deal with critics. In case you couldn't tell, my tongue was firmly in my cheek on that one. So, Nehemiah 2, verse 19. These critics of Nehemiah then begin to ridicule and trying to plant thoughts of doubt or concerns in the minds of the people concerning Nehemiah's plans. So it says, when Sanballat the Horonite, Tobiah the Ammonite official, Geshem the Arab heard of it, they laughed at us. I suspect this was publicly. They laughed at us and despised us and said, what is this thing that you are doing? Will you rebel against the king? See, you and I have the backstory. We know that Nehemiah was not rebelling. He had the letter authorizing it. Did they not know, or did they know and simply tell a lie to continue to try to create this doubt? But this is powerful, isn't it? How do you argue against a negative? It's very difficult, if not impossible, too. Our youth and God's church can face this. Oftentimes, school environment can be very unforgiving. You know, if you're different, you stand out. And even if you don't talk about your beliefs, people pick up on things. They notice that you're not eating what they eat. They notice that you don't participate in the Friday night activities, or that you don't engage in the same acceptable things that we would find to be in violation of God's instruction. But this isn't limited to the youth in God's church. Many adults can face this as well. Family, coworkers, even friends that we think can do the same thing, sometimes deliberately, sometimes not knowing. I've known individuals who have come into God's church that have literally lost all contact with family because they want nothing to do with them now that they're not part of whatever it was they were part of before. Verse 20, Nehemiah 2. So he answered them. He tries to address their lie here, and he says to them, the God of heaven himself will prosper us. Therefore, we, his servants, will arise and build. And this is the part I really like in verse 20. But you have no heritage or right or memorial in Jerusalem. Why are you here? You're not an Israelite. You're not of these tribes. This is not your place. There is a time to address the critics. But because of Nehemiah's example, the people of Jerusalem have a motivation they haven't had before. They have a motivation to finish rebuilding the wall. Because of Nehemiah's determination here and publicly visible trust in God, they're now rallied to a task that had been left unfinished for too long, way too long. But even with Nehemiah's determination, the critics weren't dissuaded. They didn't give up. If we move across to chapter 4, chapter 3 goes into more details about the rebuilding of the wall. Maybe you can read that later. It's very interesting. Nehemiah did a very smart thing. How do you motivate people to do the very best job they can do? You ask them to do the job that is important to them. So if you lived in Jerusalem and you have part of the broken wall behind your house, Nehemiah asks you to fix that portion of the wall, just that section, not the whole wall, just the piece behind your house. How good a job do you think they're going to do? They're going to do a very good job because that's behind their house. Joe can make his any way he wants to, but behind my house, I'm going to make it as strong as I can. So he goes through that. Chapter 3 goes through more of that detail. So chapter 4 and verse 6, we'll pick up the story. It says, so we built the wall, and the entire wall was joined together up to half its height. So they made progress very quickly here. For the people had a mind to work. As I mentioned, this determination can become infectious. Nehemiah's determination translated into their determination. They now had a mind to work, a goal that they all wanted to accomplish. And so then verse 7, now it happened. These critics come back. Sanballat, Tobiah, the Arabs, the Ammonites, the Ashdodites heard that the walls of Jerusalem were being restored and the gaps were beginning to be closed, and they became very angry. They're losing their influence. They're losing their control. They're losing their ability to whatever, to harass or to intimidate or to extort from the people that were there. In verse 8, all of them, all of these critics conspired together to come and attack Jerusalem and create confusion. Okay, our words are not having an effect, so we'll pool our resources and we'll go directly attack them. So instead of building, they have to deal with this that we're going to throw their way. This is an escalation in things. This hasn't gotten better. Nehemiah was supposed to come solve problems, and I suspect there were other critics. Look what you've created, perhaps. But Nehemiah didn't waver in his determination. And I think that what happens next is a great example of what I would call faith and works in action. So verse 9, he says, nevertheless, in spite of what they conspired to do, he says, we made our prayer to our God, and because of them, we set watch against them day and night. Now, is this a lack of faith? Well, he's confident. He says there, we made our prayer to God. We know that he's going to take care of us, but he's being prudent. We'll do what we can. God has to take care of the rest. So he says, we set a watch day and night. We'll see here in a moment. When they were working, there were guards, and at night, there were guards when they weren't working. Because the wall's not done yet. The gates aren't hung. Verse 10, then Judah said, the strength of the laborers is failing. There is so much rubbish that we're not able to build the wall. They had so much to take care of to even rebuild the wall. And our adversaries say they will neither know nor see anything till we come into the midst and kill them and cause the work to cease. This was the rumor being spread around. Sort of what we would call psychological warfare. We don't know when they're going to attack. We don't know how many of them they are. We don't know where they're going to attack. And you can imagine how this would wear on people. And so then verse 12. So it was when the Jews who dwelt near them came that they told us 10 times, from whatever place you turn, they will be upon us. Therefore, I positioned men behind the lower parts of the wall at the openings. I set people according to their families with their swords and their spears. And again, if you have to fight, who are you going to fight hardest to protect? Those closest to you. So he's working with them here. Verse 14, I looked and I arose and said to the nobles, to the leaders, to the rest of the people, do not be afraid of them. Don't be afraid of these critics, these ones that are threatening to come and harm us. Remember the Lord, great and awesome, and fight for your brethren, your sons, your daughters, your wives, your houses. Stand up and do the right thing. In Nehemiah's case, the right thing is to finish the wall, to allow for this protection to be there. Verse 15, and as it happened when our enemies heard that it was known to us, that is, their plot had gotten out, and that God had brought their plot to nothing. See, he grants God the favor, if you will. He could have said in that we had brought their plot to nothing, but he doesn't say that. God brought it to nothing. That all of us returned to the wall, everyone to his work. But notice, they didn't let their guard down. They simply knew that they could go back to the task. So it was from that time on that half of my servants worked at construction, while the other half held the spears. So for every workman, there was a soldier guarding that area. The shields, the bows, and armor, and the leaders were behind all the house of Judah. Even the leaders, they weren't able to sit back and supervise. Go do this, and that doesn't look right. Make sure you take care of whatever. They were involved with this as well. Those who built the wall and those who carried burdens loaded themselves so that with one hand they worked at construction, and with the other they held a weapon. Every one of the builders had his sword at his side, and the ones who sounded the trumpet were beside me. So even Nehemiah said, I have set the men around me to also be watchmen. So if those on the wall don't see the danger coming, the alarm will be sounded. We can all rally behind this. Nehemiah and the people trusted in God. They asked for His protection, His direction. Then they did what they could. Notice back in verse 14. Do not be afraid of them. The determination to press on, don't let them dissuade us. Nehemiah was a committed leader. When you couple that with godly character, an interesting thing happens. It becomes infectious. And people will follow committed leaders. Because they know they're not there just for their own glory, for their own gain. To continue the story over in chapter 6 here in Nehemiah, the critics switch tactics again. They sort of go back to what they'd done previously, but in a different way. The intimidation didn't work. The threats of violence didn't work. But they began to plant rumors this time. Nehemiah 6 and verse 1. It happened when Sanballat, Tobiah, Geshem, the Arab, the rest of our enemies heard that I had rebuilt the wall, that there were no breaks left in it, though at that time I had not hung the doors. So the wall's done, but there's still openings at the gates. That Sanballat and Geshem sent to me saying, come, let us meet together among the villages in the plain of Ono. So now that they see that none of that worked, the rebuilding has been accomplished, they present themselves now as friends. Oh, now that I see what you're doing, okay, well, come over here. Let's have a meal. Let's sit down and talk about what we can do to work together moving forward. This is what I was talking about earlier when I said Nehemiah was a man of discernment. Notice the end of verse 2. But they thought to do me harm. Nehemiah was not fooled by their ploy. His determination was not thwarted here. Verse 3, notice, I sent messengers to them saying, I'm doing a great work so that I cannot come down. Why should the work cease while I leave it and go down to you? I'm a little busy right now. If I have time, maybe, but right now, doesn't work. But notice, they didn't give up. They sent this message to me 4 times, and I answered them in the same manner. Then Sanballat sent his servant to me as before the 5th time, this time with an open letter, perhaps letting everybody know what he was going to tell Nehemiah on the way. Maybe thinking that he could cajole Nehemiah if everyone else knows, look, put the pressure on him. And so then notice the content of this letter. It is reported among the nations that Geshem says, like Geshem is somebody that should be listened to, that you and the Jews plan to rebel. You're still under King Artaxerxes, and we know you're going to rebel. According to these rumors, you are rebuilding the wall that you may be their king. I see what you're up to, Geshem says. Nehemiah is trying to make his own nation here. That you have also appointed prophets to proclaim you at Jerusalem. You know, having the religious authority, if you will. Saying, there is a king in Judah. Now these matters will be reported to the king. So come, therefore, and let us consult together. That's a threat. You come meet with us, or we're going to go tell the king this is what you're doing. Nehemiah addresses this, verse 8. No such things are as you say are being done, but you invent them in your own heart. He's resolute. For they are all trying to make us afraid, saying their hands will be weakened in the work and it will not be done. They still see opportunity to prevent this from being completed. But again, at the end of verse 9, he beseeches God to strengthen them. But it's not just critics you have to be careful of. Sometimes those closest to you can be the ones that can hurt you as well. And so in verse 10, it says, afterwards, I came to the house of Shimeiah, the son of Daliah, son of Mehetabel, who was a secret informer. That is, he's been working with these other guys, these other critics, pretending to be Nehemiah's friend while working with them. And he said, let us meet together. So this is Shemaiah speaking to Nehemiah. Let us meet together in the house of God, the temple. Come to the temple. Let us close the doors of the temple, for they are coming to kill you. You need to protect yourself, Nehemiah. And you, because we don't have gates on the city walls, the only place that's safe is in the temple. Indeed, they will come at night to kill you. Now, why was he doing this? Well, verse 11, should such a man as I flee? Shemaiah was trying to get Nehemiah to look weak, that if he was only out to protect himself, all of the good that had been done previously would have been undone. His credibility would have been shot. And so Nehemiah is saying here, look, for the leader that I'm trying to be here, that God has asked me to be, how can I do that? If I should go into the temple to save my life, verse 12, then I perceived that God had not sent him. And this is where I talked earlier about his discernment as well. He saw through this. He said, this was his prophecy against me, because Tobiah and Sanballat had hired him. For this reason he was hired, that I should be afraid and act that way in sin, so that they might have cause for an evil report, that they might reproach me. Maybe they would even take this to the king and say, look, see, when we called him on it, he tried to run. He knew we knew. Verse 14, I like the way Nehemiah approached this. My God, remember Tobiah and Sanballat according to these their works. He's not telling God what to do. He simply says, remember what they did, and I'll leave it up to you. It's hard when friends betray us. It's not that we should be fearful of that, but it puts a caution in there as well. Hold your place here in Nehemiah. We'll come back to that in a moment. But let's go to Proverbs chapter 1. Mr. Warner talked about deception in his sermonette. And we can be even deceived by friends at times. Again, not always by design. Sometimes they can mean well. But notice Solomon's instruction here, Proverbs 1, verse 10, he says, my son, if sinners entice you, do not consent. Now, how do you know if they're trying to entice you? To the point of the earlier message, you have to be aware. You have to be paying attention. Nehemiah was paying attention. He knew his relationship with the king. That was not in question. He was comfortable enough there. He knew what the king had authorized him to do. Nehemiah knew what his intent was, his own heart. He wasn't deceiving himself. We read many of those instructions where he prayed to God. He included himself in that apology, if you will, the repentance there. My father's house and this nation. So he was not deceiving himself. But the caution here is, don't follow them. If sinners entice you, pay attention. There have been times in my, especially my earlier history when I was a teen, that I would have friends and they would say, let's go do this and that or the other. And I would say, no, I can't do that. Oftentimes they would get into trouble. That was part of why it made it easy to say no. I knew they were going to get in trouble. Didn't have to go there. But sometimes it's not so clear. You have to pay attention. The godly component, character component of determination is a reminder. Remember our definition, that no matter what others may say or do, we have to stay the course for the right thing. That's the determination. Even if it's critics, even if it's supposed friends. Let's look at another reminder in Hebrews chapter 10. A true friend, and this is one of the ways we know if they're trying to entice us, a true friend will not go that route. Even if they're not trying to do something deliberately. Maybe they're asking for something and you know that's not good for you, or you know that's not the right thing, and you say, no, I'm not comfortable with that. A good friend will say, okay. And maybe there's a different or another conversation that'll be had. Rather, a good friend will do what we read of here in Hebrews 10, verse 24. Let us consider one another in order to stir up. Part of that consideration is knowing how to approach them, how to talk to them, what they're sensitive to. Maybe you can work it in into something that creates the environment. You know, when Nehemiah approached the king, he had to do it in the right way, in the right environment. So, as it says here in Hebrews, to consider one another, to stir up love and good works. Those friends will help us in our determination. They'll guide us in the right way. They'll help us to see. And I suspect Nehemiah had some of those friends. Remember, he had a small handful that he took out with him at night. He confided in. And I'm sure it wasn't just Nehemiah making decisions here. Well, here's what we're going to do, and this is what needs to be done when and how and all of these things. I suspect that they talked as a group. Well, did you see this section? Maybe we need to address that first because that's the weakest area. And maybe they came up with a plan together. I'm speculating, but I think I'm speculating on fairly solid ground here. Let's go back to Nehemiah 6 and sort of come to the conclusion of the story here in Nehemiah. After this conspiracy was thwarted, we have sort of a summary here at the end of chapter 6. Nehemiah 6, verse 15, Nehemiah writes, "So the wall was finished. The determination to see the walls repaired, the gates finished, that he brought before the king." It says it's done. But to me, what is astounding is he says there on the 25th day of Elul, in 52 days. If we were to read this book and not have this verse, we'd have no clue how long this took. Could have been half a year, could have been 2 years, it could have been a long time. They'd spent over 90 years accomplishing nothing. Okay, so it wouldn't be unreasonable to think, well, it took them another 10 years to get their act together and get it done. But 52 days. That's determination, isn't it? Less than 2 months from the time Nehemiah showed up, they came up with a game plan. He got the support of the leadership. He fired up the imagination and the vision of the people. They put their hands to the task, as we read earlier, and in less than 2 months, it's done. Not just haphazard done. As my grandmother used to say, a nod and a wink. Which means you didn't really do anything, but you just think it's okay. They didn't plaster over it to hide it. They did a good job. For the length of time that had been unrepaired, the walls and the gates were unreplaced, it was astounding that they accomplished this. Nehemiah's determination, certainly. God's blessing, absolutely. But the will of the people. Remember what I said earlier. Determination can be infectious. The right leader. And in 52 days, they did what had been left undone for decades. What are you determined to accomplish? See, the example of Nehemiah is to be an object lesson for us. God records these things not to impress us, although we can be impressed, but so that we can say, well, wait a minute, if Nehemiah can do that, what can I do with God through me? What are you determined to accomplish? I can't do anything for anyone else in terms of salvation. I can't give you biblical knowledge. I can't give you God's Holy Spirit. I can't give you salvation. I can't do any of that. My responsibility is to help you to the best of my ability. But we each stand or fall on our own, don't we? We have to determine what we're going to do. Are you determined to accomplish what God has put your feet to? We can say yes, but you know, the sad caution is how many people used to be in this congregation here in Milwaukee that are no longer? I use that because you're familiar with that. I can tell you in Cincinnati that there's less than a tenth of the people who used to attend there even 25 years ago. Those people thought they were determined. So it's a caution that we should keep in mind. What could we accomplish as a church, as a local congregation, if we had this type of determination? Look at what they accomplished. When they finally put their hand to it, when they were determined to finally finish it, does Nehemiah's example inspire you? Or are you tired, like so many in the world are, and they simply wait for someone else to take care of their needs? Okay, well, that works in the short time, but you know what you give up? Freedom, control of your own destiny. Pharaoh had all the grain, right? He took care of the people. But what did they have to do in exchange? Give him their wealth, their land. And they became slaves. It's ironic. The Israelites left free and the Egyptians stayed as slaves. United church camps, not United youth camps, go through these lessons for this reason, so that we can begin to challenge the youth to think along these lines. And along with these sub-themes, the themes each day during camp, we have a memory verse that's usually connected to it. And it's not a memory verse just for the sake of memorizing a verse. There is some value in just doing that. But the verse is to continue this connection to the lesson of the day. The activity staff is asked to repeat it, to ask the dorms when they come to the activity, what's the memory verse? What have you learned from that? What application do you see in that with the theme of the day? The counselors remind the campers throughout the day. They talk about it in the dorms as they're walking between activities. When the campers gather in the evening, and this varies from camp to camp, some camps have what's called a Christian living class in the evening. Some have what they call a fireside chat. But there's a repetition at the end of the day. Sometimes it's as a whole group. Sometimes it's individual dorms. Do you remember this theme? Can you quote it from memory? Turn with me, please, to Psalm 37. This was the memory verse for this theme during camp. Psalm 37, two verses actually, verses 4 and 5. Delight yourself also in the Eternal. He will give you the desires of your heart. If we value what God values, then He will give us what we desire. And it's not just because we desire it. An interesting thing happens is that we begin to desire what God desires. And that's exactly what He wants to accomplish. He wants us to want the same thing that He wants. Look at Nehemiah's example. What did Nehemiah desire? Jerusalem to be reestablished. God's people to be gathered again, to be a model to the other nations. God gave him that, didn't He? We don't know how long a time period Nehemiah told Artaxerxes. Did he tell him 2 weeks? Wouldn't have that been bold? Before he ever went to Judea to say, give me 2 weeks and I'll be back. Did he say 2 years? I don't know. But God certainly delivered, didn't He? Verse 5, Psalm 37. Commit your ways to the Eternal. That's determination. Determine to follow God in your way of life. Trust in Him, and He will bring it to pass. See, that's another difference about leaders that God looks for and leaders of the world. We don't have to do this all ourselves. When we commit to God, when we determine that we will follow His way of life, we will set our foot to His path, and we will be obedient, we will yield to His instruction, we will become like Him, then as it says here, He'll bring it to pass. It's not just us. If it was, we would get very tired. And unfortunately, I think that's why so many have left. They tried to do too much on their own. Delight yourself also in the Lord, and He will give you the desires of your heart. Commit your ways to the Lord. Trust also in Him, and He will bring it to pass. To conclude here, I'd like to leave you with a poem that I came across. It's very fitting for the message today. The author is unknown, and I'll just read it to you as I have it. It starts by saying, "Press on. Nothing in the world can take the place of persistence. Talent will not, for nothing is more common than unsuccessful men with talent. Genius will not. Unrewarded genius is almost a proverb. Education will not. The world is full of educated derelicts. Persistence and determination alone are important. Persistence and determination. May we all be a people of godly character and determination.